Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here at Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. In the next hour, I'll be talking to Ivan Carvalho in Milan, a former student of Christopher Hitchens who passed away last night. We'll continue our scan of the world's high streets, finding out who does it best, and today we ask why Japan gets it right.
And I think a couple of decades ago, that kind of retail sector didn't really exist so much because there wasn't the demand. So it's interesting to see how quickly these shops have come up and adapted to the current economic climate.
That was Monocle's Tokyo correspondent, Danielle Dimitriou. And rounding off our Alpino newspaper preview, we'll be joined by Monocle's very own Marcus Hippi to talk about reindeer meat in Finland. All this, plus we meet our whiskey-selling neighbours, and we'll be playing some of my great music too, here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. France's foreign ministry has stepped in to settle an increasingly heated argument with Britain over whose economy has shown the poorer performance. Ministry spokesperson Bernard Vallereau made the attempt to calm the disagreement that has set central bankers and ministers from both sides of the channel against each other. Mr. Vallereau stressed that France needed the UK as an ally, not an adversary.
We really need to work closely together. President Sarkozy said recently in an interview in a French newspaper, President Sarkozy said, we need UK.
An American Army intelligence analyst accused of giving hundreds of thousands of classified US documents to WikiLeaks for public disclosure has made his first court appearance to face charges which could send him to prison for life. Private First Class Bradley Manning went on trial at a courthouse at the Fort Meade military base in Maryland. Demonstrators gathered outside Fort Meade to support Manning. Among them was Daniel Choi, a former US Army lieutenant.
I'm here because Bradley Manning, Private First Class Manning, is a good soldier who stood up for the truth and lived the Army values. And I believe that all soldiers need to follow that example to base their actions on those virtues that we protect.
If convicted of all counts, Manning would face a maximum punishment of life imprisonment, reduction in rank to the lowest enlisted pay grade, forfeiture of all pay and allowances, and a dishonorable discharge. Russia has been admitted into the World Trade Organization after 18 years of negotiation. Russia's $1.9 trillion economy was the largest outside the WTO. Experts believe its accession will help reduce dependence on energy exports that left Russia seriously exposed to the oil price collapse of 2008. And Russia's economy minister, Elvira Nabiullina, said membership should allow Russia to recoup lost export earnings to the tune of $2 billion a year. 10 people have been killed in clashes between sacked oil workers and police in the city of Zhanaozen in western Kazakhstan. The country's prosecutor general, Askat Dolbayev, told reporters that protesters had set fire to the city administration building and the headquarters of an oil company. Police across Europe have arrested more than 100 people for sharing the worst of the worst child sexual abuse images across the internet. House-to-house searches across 26 countries involved swoops on previously unknown networks of child sex offenders who were sharing videos online. The operation, codenamed Project Icarus, was coordinated by the European law enforcement agency Europol, whose director Rob Wainwright described what had been found.
Huge quantities of illegal material have been identified, tracked and confiscated, including large amounts of what we see to be the most extreme forms of video material featuring the sexual abuse of young children and even babies.
He said so much material was seized it would take months or even years to analyse. Those are all the stories at the top of the hour at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. Now let's take a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Europe and France has just been swept by quite a nasty storm. High winds and waves have battered coasts. Inland gusts have reached 120 kilometres an hour. The worst weather will be over central parts of the continent. Over the next 24 hours, more wind, rain and snow. Certainly snow in the Alps. Ferocious winds there too. The cold snap will last through the weekend across much of Europe. The Mediterranean will also feel the chilly weather. Here's the weekend city outlook. And in London, 3 degrees, cold winds, partly cloudy. In Zurich, around 0 Celsius, occasional snow. Vienna, 5 degrees and cloudy. And Milan, it's only 5 degrees as well, partly cloudy. North America now. The weather here will become quite tranquil and mostly sunny over the weekend. At the moment, not quite the case. Rain over the Mississippi, heading towards Washington, D.C. and the Carolinas. But as I say, over the weekend, the sun should be back in most major cities of the U.S. and indeed Canada. Here's the weekend city outlook. New York, 6 Celsius and sunny. In Chicago, it's 0 degrees, mostly sunny. Denver, 8 degrees, partly cloudy. And in LA, it's a pleasant 17, breezy with some sunshine. And other world destinations for the next couple of days. In South Africa and Cape Town, some good weather here. Temperatures in the mid-20s. It should stay like it into the business week. In the Middle East, Abu Dhabi, Dubai and Doha, all sunny. Highs of around 22 to 24 degrees. The early mornings, a little on the cool side now. It can be as low as 11 Celsius in Doha. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on the Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Thomas. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24, Tagat, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, ja, joo, kun saa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propajalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, news broke overnight that one of the world's most renowned and celebrated journalists, Christopher Hitchens, had passed away. Hitchens was the journalist's journalist. Prolific, always engaging, and often enraging with his unswerving secularist opinions. He died at the age of 62 after losing his battle with esophageal cancer. A battle he documented to the last with extraordinary candidness. Our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho was a student of Hitchens, and he joins us on the line now. Ivan, I wonder if you could maybe start by telling us in what capacity you actually knew Christopher.
Good evening, Hugo. I had the fortunate opportunity to attend a seminar taught by Christopher Hitchens back in 2002 in the fall, and it was a seminar dedicated to investigative journalists and writers such as Mencken, Upton Sinclair, I.F. Stone, George Orwell, which everyone knows was an author very close to Christopher Hitchens in terms of a great inspiration to Hitchens.
And you continued to have some sort of contact with him after this, didn't you? You mentioned to me earlier that you had seen him in Milan as well.
Yes, I had exchanged in the past some email correspondence with him, and also met up with him once in Rome. Christopher was always generous with his time, with many people, with activists, former students, as well as with obviously the intellectuals and academics and authors who he would meet with and debate. He was really an inspiring individual, and I remember at this conference in Rome that he took the time out to sit down and have a drink before he went to a formal luncheon, and always would spare a few minutes. He, even on email, was very quick to respond.
And I mean, something from so many of the reports that have been pouring in over the day, from so many great names around the world saying how much he will be missed. One thing that strikes me is quite how prolific he was. He apparently could rattle off articles of thousands of words in minutes. And the one that everybody's really pointing to is the last piece he wrote for Vanity Fair, documenting how Nietzsche's saying of whatever doesn't kill me makes me stronger was something he'd always sort of stood by, but in his last few months was realising was increasingly ridiculous. And I mean, the way he documented his illness and right up until his death has been incredibly, well, shocking, but shocking because it was so frank.
Yes, no, he would never mince words. Christopher Hitchens It's a great loss because of his ability, his way with language, the clarity, both in his writing and also in conversation and debate. If one ever had the opportunity to see him in a debate, it was just astounding. I recall during my time at Berkeley with him, there was a debate just a few months prior to the beginning of the Iraq War, which everyone knows that he went on to support, which was seen as sort of a watershed moment for a lot of people in terms of how they viewed Christopher Hitchens. And that, at debate at Berkeley, the classic left-wing bastion, there was Hitchens debating a writer from The New Yorker. And it was quite amazing, the strength of his arguments, and even with a crowd that was obviously on the side of not going in and intervention, the ability of him to construct an argument and the clarity, also when he would teach students, it would always to remember to always banish stock phrases and cliches, and it's a great loss because today with all these armchair pundits and talking heads on the TV networks, there isn't a lot of space out there to have these conversations on programs, and that will be a great loss, I think.
Definitely, and what you say there about being a fantastic orator who can construct an argument really sort of against the flood of perceived opinion is very true indeed. He was a fantastic public intellectual, and as you say, this sort of plethora of armchair critics that has sort of the internet we blame here, popular media of all sorts, where everybody's entitled to an opinion, but nobody ever really stands up and argues it out or is afraid to actually come out and speak up. We're losing this sort of breed of journalist here in the world today, I think, aren't we?
Yes, because he was one who visited a lot of so-called hot. He visited the hot zones. For example, he was in Sarajevo during the Bosnian conflict. He would undergo things. For example, the famous case when he underwent waterboarding voluntarily to show that this was a form of torture and the United States shouldn't be practicing it. He was always there on the front line. Never one of these people who would just sit back in a cozy office and write out the articles and never have real contact with a lot of these areas, meeting up with activists around the world. And that is something that, because the memories and the stories that he would tell during these seminars were just quite amazing, because as everyone probably has commented in the last 24 hours, his ability to recall conversations, quotations, whether it be Shakespeare or something from Orwell or Mark Twain or what have you, it was just astounding, especially in the public debates. He would come out with these quotes out of nowhere. The zingers, the put-downs were just astounding. It's something that I imagine people will be going on YouTube to look for, some of these debates that he participated in, because it's really something to study.
Of course, and we touched earlier on his support of the Iraq War, but the other sort of big topic has been his sort of extreme atheism and his sort of denouncing of religion, most sort of acutely in his 2007 book, God Is Not Great. But how do you feel he will be remembered sort of a decade from now or even 50 years ahead?
Yeah, that'll be interesting, because right now I think a lot of the discussion is about the recent years and the debate on debates on atheism, for example, and those recent books. The Iraq War is still obviously there in the minds of a lot of people. I'd be very curious to see his legacy in 20, 25 years. Hopefully, it'll be in the pantheon of some of the writers that he was teaching in that seminar, such as Mencken, for example, I.F. Stone, Orwell. People who traveled, to a lot of places were able to chronicle and capture, often in very short pieces, the context and the events at that particular moment. And so, perhaps that will be his legacy.
Ivan Carvalho, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back now. It's time for a song. This is Crazy in Love by Anthony and the Johnsons.
Thank you.
That was Crazy in Love by Anthony and the Johnsons. Coming up on Midori House, we'll be hearing from Monocle's Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi to talk food and hospitality in 2012. Stay with us.
Monocle is strapping on its skis, pulling on its mittens, and heading to the mountains for the launch of our winter resort paper, Monocle Alpino. This large format paper takes you to the snowy highs of Slovenia and Sochi and discovers a little piece of Italy marooned in Switzerland. It also offers glowing reads, homes to encourage you to build an alpine roost, hearty recipes, and puffed up cozy fashions for heading out in a snow flurry. We also go on rescue missions in Iceland and find the ultimate mountain cinemas and newspapers. Monocle Alpino is on sale now, and it's the perfect companion for a fireside moment. Tack!
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, every day this week, we've been joined in the studio by Monocle's section editors for a bit of crystal ball gazing in their field of expertise. Today, we turn to Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi to talk about Section E of Monocle, food and hospitality.
There are several trends for 2012. I'm going to start with a gory one because blood is going to be all over the restaurants next year.
I'm a bit squeamish when it comes to blood.
I know. But there's a saying in France that goes something like, dans les cochons, tout est bon. And within the pig, everything is good and everything has to be used. So blood is appearing on the menus more and more. There's going to be blood pancakes and sauces thickened with blood. And there's also a chef called Jennifer McLagan, who has a recipe for chocolate blood ice cream in her latest book.
I'm not sure how I feel about that. I mean, we've been eating grisly bits of animals in London for some time, thanks to Fergus Henderson and his nose-to-tail eating habits and book, I think, even. Blood is probably the last taboo. Are you a fan of it?
Well, I have eaten the morcillas or blood sausages that we
yes,
have in Colombia and Latin America.
You black also, pudding obviously in Scotland, which I'm a fan of, actually.
You have black pudding. So I don't know if it's... I've never really tasted like a blood sauce or a blood pancake. So I don't know what to expect from it.
No, I think warm blood sauce is... I don't know. Maybe it's a hangover of the whole vampire craze that's been sweeping Hollywood
maybe.
And television.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I'm not sure I'll be indulging in that, but I'll watch others and see what their reactions are and what else is there.
Well, also, René Redzepi, the chef at Anoma, started this whole locavore and foraging trend or idea of going nearby to where you are, to where you live, and and source the food yourself. This is also known as the kilometer zero trend, where you try to source everything from nearby and from local producers, and that way, being eco-friendly and
learning a little bit about the food that's on your doorstep.
Definitely, yeah, and meeting the people, the producers that are selling the food.
And this is something, again, that we've sort of seen the rumblings of and something that I enjoy. It has quite a sort of cultish appeal to it. I went to a talk recently in London from a sort of lecturer on foraging. And people were whipped into a fervour and then went out into their local parks and stripped it bare of every berry and mushroom that was to be found.
What have you foraged in East London?
I haven't foraged for much in East London, if I'm being honest.
A burger.
But in the highlands of Scotland where I grew up, mushroom picking, berry picking was very much a part of sort of seasonal, well, knowing what was in season at each time and going out and collecting it. And in Finland, it's a huge thing. And they actually have a bit of a problem because I think something like only 1% of the berries and mushrooms that grow in Finland are picked each year.
Wow.
And yet the supermarkets are stuffed with food that's imported and
wow.
very expensive. So this is definitely something that's kind of gathering momentum around the world.
Yeah, and it will keep growing next year. I personally would be scared of picking the wrong mushroom, but... I might give it a try.
You can get a very easy guide, which lets you know the ones to avoid.
In the meantime, I think I want to stick with the Cicchetti. You know, the Cicchetti are probably going to replace the tapas next year. These are small
okay.
Italian dishes, usually served in osterias in the Veneto region. So this is good for a quick bite, or if you order several, you can organize a proper meal. What else is on the horizon? Kimchi seems to be very attractive. In Spain, kimchi obviously being the fermented vegetable and soy sauce mixture coming from Korea.
From Korea, this is the continued Koreanization of the world.
Yes, yes. Obviously, it has a very strong taste, so it will probably be served in foams or emulsions and sauces instead of
right.
as a regular main dish.
Okay, no, you have to eat kimchi with something. I think from my experience, it's not the kind of thing you can tuck into for a meal on its own. And actually, I wanted to go back quickly to René Redzepi, because also he has started a school, I think. Is this the foraging school that he started?
Yes, well, that was another one of my bullet points.
Oh, sorry,
here.
I'm jumping ahead.
No, don't worry. The food education.
Yes, exactly.
René Redzepi obviously started the Nordic Food Lab and the MAD Food Camp. Ferran Adrià has the El Bulli Foundation. The Basque country and Spain has inaugurated the Culinary Basque Center. So all of these centers will focus on studying the food from a scientific point of view, taking textures and flavors to a whole new level.
So this is science and food coming together in a sort of understanding what happens to certain types of food when it reaches a certain temperature or when it's combined
exactly.
with something else. I love this whole chemical sort of breakdown. It's something that where I, not on the staff at Monocle, I might like to be doing it myself, enrolling in Ferran Adrià's school, perhaps.
I prefer food as it usually is, as it usually is.
Like comes blood.
Like blood. No, but I prefer to see what it is and know what I'm eating and like understand the way it is made and the texture it has to have. I don't know about these cheese raviolis and infusions of...
You're not a fan of complex foods?
No, not really. I always get confused.
No, I know. I like a bit of both in my life. Now, from food to travel and hotels, what's going on the hotel scene next year?
Well, obviously, airplanes. There's going to be a lot of big mergers in Europe. Bigger plane companies are going to start eating up the smaller companies in joint ventures.
Of course.
The seatings will probably become more comfortable. So there's going to be more leg room in some of the seatings.
And is this just in first and business class, or are we talking economy as well?
This is first and business class mostly.
Okay.
Unlucky for us who have to travel in economy all the time. And switching to hotels, hotels will start offering more VIP services. Just to give you a couple of examples, the Peninsula in Beverly Hills has designated an airport concierge and a team of five attendants that go to LA's International Airport and meets the travelers there, takes them into the lounges, helps with the check-in and speed the security processes and so on. And even sometimes they manage to get some seating upgrades.
My goodness. So the treatment starts before you even arrive at the hotel.
Exactly. Or when you're going back and maybe just like as a nice farewell.
And is this in a bid to sort of secure first-time guests or to wow people who are travelling there in the hope that then they become return customers? Because, I mean, it seems incredibly extravagant to offer these kind of services at a time when, you know, holidays are still quite a luxury experience for many.
Well, to be honest, I think it's good for both. If it was my first time staying there and knowing that they offer that service, that's a plus, obviously. And once I stay there, if I'm happy with the service, I would probably go back and repeat the same hotel. Now that you talk about recurring customers, the Four Seasons and Ritz-Carlton hotels in Chicago are offering to store the repeat clientele's clothes.
Really?
In the houses.
No, so you can have a permanent wardrobe in a hotel.
Yeah. They only charge for the laundering, but it's a good way to travel light.
Very good, particularly for business travelers.
Yeah, you don't have to carry all those bags.
No, I think that maybe our editor-in-chief would love that service.
And finally, pop-up hotels.
Right, okay.
These new inns that are open for only a couple of months are going to become very popular. One that's been talked about recently is the Papaya Playa in Mexico's Mayan Riviera. It's going to have a mix of chefs flying in from 42 Raw in Copenhagen, other chefs coming in from chefs and bartenders coming in from Germany, DJs from all over the world, and so on. And these are nice bungalows that were previously deserted or vacant and have now been taken over, revamped for a couple of months.
I wonder what happens, though, from the point of view of sustainability for something like this, where is it the Papaya Playa, you say? And that's a series of cabanas on the beach.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, lovely idea to fly people in from all over the world and have this as something temporary. It would create an enormous amount of buzz. But what happens when everybody leaves and are the cabanas just left on the beach to rot?
Well, to start, the cabanas were already there, if I'm not wrong.
Right.
So I'm sure that they will be used for other purposes.
Okay. And will you be flying over there yourself?
Only if you come. Yeah.
There we go. That's our forecast. You and me in a cabana on Papaya Playa in, where is it? Mexico.
Mexico. That's a good year to come.
Definitely. 2012. You can find us on the beach in Mexico enjoying some pop-up entertainment. But thank you very much for joining me, Santiago. And happy Christmas.
Thank you very much, Hugo.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now it's time for the news headlines with James Luckhurst.
France's foreign ministry has stepped in to settle an increasingly heated argument with Britain over whose economy has shown the poorer performance. Ministry spokesperson Bernard Valero made the attempt to calm the disagreement that has set central bankers and ministers from both sides of the channel against each other. An American Army intelligence analyst accused of giving hundreds of thousands of classified US documents to WikiLeaks for public disclosure has made his first court appearance to face charges which could send him to prison for life. Private First Class Bradley Manning went on trial at a courthouse at the Fort Meade military base in Maryland. Russia has been admitted into the World Trade Organization after 18 years of negotiation. Russia's $1.9 trillion economy was the largest outside the WTO. Experts believe its accession will help reduce dependence on energy exports that left Russia seriously exposed to the oil price collapse of 2008. 10 people have been killed in clashes between sacked oil workers and police in the city of Zhanaozen in western Kazakhstan. The country's prosecutor general, Askat Dolbayev, told reporters that protesters had set fire to the city administration building and the headquarters of an oil company. Italy has been told it should put stronger emphasis on structural measures in future budgets. The EU's Economic and Monetary Affairs Commissioner, Olli Rehn, also urged the country to step up its fight against tax evasion. Police across Europe have arrested more than 100 people for sharing the worst of the worst child sexual abuse images across the internet. House-to-house searches across 26 countries involved swoops on previously unknown networks of child sex offenders who were sharing videos online. Those are all the stories at the top of the hour at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. Now time for a song, I think. This is Like a Prayer by the Lost Fingers.
Life is a mystery. Everyone must stand alone. I hear you call my name. Just like a prayer. Your voice can take me there. It's like a dream to me. Just like a prayer. Your voice can take me there. Just like a prayer.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. That was Like a Prayer by the Lost Fingers. Now it's time to open the pages of our winter newspaper, Monocle Alpino. And we all week have been previewing different sections. Joining me now in the studio is Monocle's producer, or one of Monocle 24's producers, Marcus Hippy.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for joining me, Marcus. You're here to tell us about a story that you wrote in the edits section about reindeers and reindeer meat producers, to be a bit more specific.
Yeah, it's really interesting noticing in England how interested people are in reindeer.
I know. Well, we were chatting about this during the song, about the fact that, people around the world eat venison with no qualms and nobody's the slightest bit squeamish about it. Is it the association that reindeers have with Father Christmas and Santa that makes people think twice about the idea of putting it in their mouth?
I think that's a really good theory. I think it's really something that, you know, you think that reindeer actually are like, they are living creatures, personalities and so on. You know them from popular culture. You know that Santa Claus is reindeers and so on. You know that they are kind. Even though I have to point out that we learned on last Sunday's Monocle Weekly that reindeer are not always nice. We spoke to this reindeer farmer that's been interviewed for this article, and he actually mentioned that some of the reindeer can be evil.
Okay, so they're not all cute and cuddly and pulling Santa's sleigh the whole year round?
No, supposedly not.
And tell me, you, the producer, or rather the reindeer herder that you met, is Janne Mustonen.
Janne Mustonen, yeah.
And you went up to, or you spoke to him. He's in Lapland, in Unarinluusua.
Unarinluusua.
Yeah, very nice. What does being a reindeer herder involve? Because from the article that I've just read, it sounds like he actually has to go and catch the reindeer himself. He doesn't breed them.
No, that's actually true. Like, basically, for most of the year, the reindeer, they are roaming wild in the nature. And it's quite interesting that owners, herders, they know where the animals are.
How do they catch them? They don't just run after them and grab their antlers from them.
Pretty much almost, actually. You sort of like take them to a place where you can sort of like, where you have to force them to some kind of place where they can't escape, and then you just keep them there.
Really, a corner somewhere?
Yeah, a corner.
In the middle of Lapland.
A corner. And what's really interesting, what's not mentioned in that article, is that nowadays there's modern technology helping reindeer herders to find their animals. GPS technology, reindeer tracking.
Of course. Well, that must change the game completely. Another thing you told me during the song that I was very interested by was the fact that you can't ask a reindeer herder how many reindeer he looks after. It's a bit like asking somebody how much they earn.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, that's something I had forgotten myself as well, even though I'm Finnish and I know that. And I asked that question.
It's extraordinary. I mean, it sounds like a fascinating industry. And here we have beautiful pictures of herds of reindeer running around in the early winter sunlight in the forest of Lapland. I have to say, even looking at these pictures, it would make me think twice about tucking into one. But were I to eat it, how would you eat it in a traditional Finnish way?
I think the most common way the Finns eat reindeer is so-called sauteed reindeer, which is quite common. It's quite a common restaurant food. If you go to, you know, if you go to your typical Finnish restaurant, you will most probably find that version of reindeer from
sauteed
there.
Sauteed with maybe a sort of berry jam?
Yeah, with lingonberries normally.
Lingonberries,
yeah,
so like Sweden as well.
And mashed potatoes as well.
Mashed potato. Yeah. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Marcus Hippy, and thank you for a lovely piece. You can see that and a lot more about various food producers who are working in cold climates in the Monocle Alpino, which is out, well, as soon as the holidays kick off in all airports and big magazine shops around the world, particularly in the Alpine region. Now, we are heading to a short break, but do stay with us. We've got some great music coming up next.
We have 7 Monocle shops around the world, in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Osaka, and 2 in Tokyo, where you can find a full range of Monocle products perfect for a Christmas gift for your loved ones. We're now carrying the latest in Monocle collaborations, including Drake's winter gloves and scarves, Anderson sailor sweaters, Velextra grip wallets, Todd's passport holders, and of course, the Monocle 24 Revo radio, so you can listen to us in high fidelity sound. So at home or away, drop by a Monocle shop. We'd love to show you around.
It's
If you've missed any of your favourite programmes on Monocle.com, tune in or download The Curator, our Sunday roundup of the best of the week's programmes on Monocle 24. With a different editor hosting every week, The Curator is your quick and easy way into the week's stories on Monocle 24. That's The Curator, brought to you in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24, every Sunday at 1300 London time, or via our timeshare player on monocle.com and on iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now it's time for another song. We've just been hearing about lingonberries, which you eat with reindeer in Finland. And this is Linger by the Cranberries. That was Linger by the Cranberries. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now tucked in a green and gold storefront on London's Chiltern Street, a bustling road stuffed with small boutiques and cafes, is Cadenheads, whisky shop and tasting room. Formerly of Covent Garden, Cadenheads is, like our own Midori House here, a relative newcomer to the neighbourhood. In a bottle-packed tasting room in the back of the store, Monocle sat down with manager Stephen Worrell, who told us about the intricacies and pleasures of a solid scotch.
It's the Cadenheads Whisky Shop and Tasting Room in London, and obviously, from the name, we deal with whisky, and we also have tasting sessions that we run here where people book in to actually discover what whisky's like and how it's best to drink it, what do those silly tasting notes mean. You know, it's like a mist rolling down a peat and heather moor. Sounds very depressing to me, but we try and break all of that down so people work with their own taste experience, because taste is all based upon memory. And so that's how we help people work through it.
What kind of people come in here? Who are your customers?
Very, very wide variety of people. In fact, we just finished with a session with some people from Bombay, just left now. They're heading on a flight now back home in the next couple of hours. We get people from all over the world. So you can go from the guy who's working in a garage, to the street cleaner, to you name it, they will come in and do a tasting.
And everybody here is super passionate about whiskey.
You have to be. You have to know what the product is. You have to know the history. If you don't have that knowledge, it sounds so unconvincing, and you may as well just go to a supermarket and just pick blindly off the shelf. We're here to fill that gap, or in fact, to continue the tradition of whisky.
What's the history of the store?
This store originally started 19 years ago in Covent Garden. We were based there on Russell Street, and we were looking for a new premises. This came up. We liked the area because it's very much like Covent Garden used to be, a bit more so like boutique shops, no big chains, and so we resettled here. I think it's our fourth year coming up now. The company, Cadenheads, has been going since 1842. And what we do, we supply whiskies direct from a single barrel. We don't water it down. We don't chill filter it by taking the proteins and oils out of the whisky. We don't add artificial colour. It's just whisky in its natural form.
What are some of the popular distilleries here?
The most popular one we sell by 10 to 1 is Springbank. And we have a big, big waiting list for the new Springbank 21-year-old that was due to be out now, but a little bit like Apple with a sort of like, you know, we know it's coming. We don't know what it's going to look like. We don't know much about it, but we know it's going to be, well, I know it's fantastic. I've tried it. It's going to be a fresh sherry wood, 21 years. It's the first release this millennium of this particular whiskey. And it was actually voted by whisky drinkers the best whisky of all time for the last century. So everybody's waiting with anticipation for it to come back. The problem we've had is just getting that packaging absolutely spot on, because it's such a special bottling that we just don't want to get it wrong.
How does the tasting process work? Do people come in here and they choose a particular bottle and they taste it and then they buy it?
No, that would be a pub. We're not like that. No, what I mean, you can see on the mantelpiece there that we've selected six whiskies, because that's the tasting would cover six. And what we try and do within that tasting session is take you from the very light to the very complex and heavy. So, for instance, we start off with an Ockintosh, an 11-year-old, which is a beautifully soft, unpeated malt, to a very complex Laphroaig 13-year-old. It's a new bottling, just come out. It's 60.6 volume, not your 40 volume that you're going to buy elsewhere. It's 60.6 volume. And what we try and do is get people to explore all the tastes in between. So you've got Glenmarais, then we go to Tomartin, a 17-year-old. We've got a Ben Nevis matured in a rum cask. And my particular favourite at the moment is the Claretwood Springbank, which is very fruity, very this time of the year, winter fruits. And
so it's a highly curated process.
Yeah, if I've got three or four tastings on in a day, I'll listen to what the customers say that they don't like. Say, for instance, I always ask the question, well, what don't you like? And I'll tailor it, so I may have to take one or two of them out and swap them over. So that's why we've got the other selection over there. So I'm picking out different whiskies to slot in, but without compromising the build-up in taste that we work with. Because we want people to experience the whole of Scotland and not be stuck, tied to a pole, walking around, just trying one style. It's nothing more boring.
What's it like being on the street?
Oh, about here is the fact that it's a
neighbourhood.
It's part of London. It's still got a community feel to it. And when people talk about London, I mean, we're Oxford Street's 5 minutes away, but you wouldn't think when anywhere near the hub and the madness of Oxford Street and Oxford Circus. It's a bit of a village feel to it, and that's quite unique in London to still have that. We've got really great, you know, the people at the landlords of the area are fantastic because they're looking to keep the area as independent as possible. You know, no big multinational chains are coming in, which is fantastic for us. We've got a new hotel going to open up across the road from us in the old fire station. You know, you get to know all the people who live here. We respect this is their home at the end of the day. We're a business that's just trading here. But they come in, they book their tasting sessions with us, and we can have, you know, you can have a chat, you can relax a little bit. It's not quite as manic as going, say, to another area of London where, you know, you're forced to sell somebody something very, very quickly, in and out the door, in and out the door. It's not like that here. It's a bit more relaxed.
That was Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli reporting from Monocle 24 in London's Chiltern Street and Cadenhead's Whiskey Shop and Tasting Room. Time for a song now. It's another cover, actually. There's been a bit of a covers theme today. This is Running Up That Hill by the Heavenly Music Association. That was Running Up That Hill by the Heavenly Music Association, and heavenly it was indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, earlier this week on Midori House, we checked in with our correspondents in LA and Copenhagen to hear how their high streets compare to those in Britain, which are ailing, to say the least. Now it's time to cross over to Japan to see how they do it. And earlier today, I spoke to Monocle's Danielle Dimitriou in Tokyo.
A lot of the communities within Tokyo and outside Tokyo actually revolve around the structure of, or traditionally revolved around the structure of shotengai, which are these old kind of shopping arcades. So these are very, very traditional parts of the community. They still exist, but they're kind of declining at the moment. So they would basically be the traditional kind of backbone of the community, and they'd have the local kind of fishmongers and fruit and vegetable places, butchers and coffee shops and pachinko and izakaya. And these are in a lot of trouble at the moment in Japan because of the... It's quite similarly, actually, to the UK, because of the rise of the bigger out-of-town shopping centres and the shrinking populations. The growth of people driving more cars and not shopping, the things not being so centralised, basically.
And are different towns and cities trying to do anything to address this decline in the traditional sort of market shopping scene?
Well, Yeah, it's a very difficult situation to reverse, because obviously at the same time, as you were saying, in Tokyo, you can look at Tokyo and you can see it as a very successful retail model as well. And it's difficult to sustain both the very local community-led kind of shopping arcade side of things, along with the kind of bigger, more modern success stories. So the government has in the past tried to pass various laws to tighten regulations in the context of big commercial developments, in the hope that it would protect these shotengai. But to be honest, it hasn't had that much of an effect. So I think the only way forward really is for these shotengai, individual shop owners, to actually modernize, take the initiative to modernize themselves, or if there are incentives for younger people to set up businesses in these areas, that would help revive them or get involved in online retail as well, because obviously there are lots of very successful Japanese retail online models, and other kind of very more modern, much more modern and more successful retail examples that these shotengai could take inspiration from.
Exactly. I mean, we've got a big piece in our February issue of Monocle coming up on Tsutaya, which is obviously... Yeah. The sort of Japanese equivalent of Blockbuster, I suppose, what we have in the UK and in America that people could most liken it to. But this is a company that really does a lot to create an interesting and exciting retail environment. And they've just opened this huge... it's really like a retail community in Tokyo, haven't they?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It's a lovely development. It's in Daikinyama. And it's very different from anything that anyone in Japan would previously associate with the company. All its main retail outlets are normally have those big kind of blue and yellow signs, big Tsutaya sign, a bit like Blockbusters. But basically, the new development it's designed by KDA, and it's a very sleek development, and it's projecting a very different image from its usual kind of more standard outlet. So it's very interesting that it's tapping into a different sector, a different market, but at the same time expanding in a positive way.
That was Monocle's correspondent in Tokyo, Danielle Dimitriou, and I'm afraid that's all we've got time for in this edition of Midori House. But we will be coming back to you live at 2200 hours this evening with The Daily. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump, researched by Alberto Pickers, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Headlines are next, right here on Monocle 24. Stay tuned, and don't forget to tune in for our special Christmas schedule, which starts tomorrow. Goodbye.